Christology Podcast. We are on with our very good friend, Lieutenant Colonel retired Jeff Teagues. Can you hear the music, boss?
I can't. I just hear like a little bass every once in a while. I can't hear it.
I'm kind of overly proud of it because I put it together and yeah.
That's awesome.
I'll get over it in time. Jeff Teagues, it's so glad to have you finally. What?
Are there supposed to be numbers going on those two black squares at the bottom?
No, because we're not okay. Streaming.
All right, got it.
Jeff Teagues, it's so glad to have you, man. We used to drive into work together, and then I realized just how different we are when we drove in together. We had a mammoth.
We're OTC, dude. We weren't even deemed worthy yet. We were still trying to make it.
Yeah. And what really said something about you to me, because we didn't go through selection together. You were hurt and I was a retread. So we came in, Laura, to do this, a PT test that takes like 2 hours and there's a 5 mile run at the end. And like, it just crushed me. And Jeff here warmed up by running like 2 miles on a treadmill. You remember that?
You guys are crazy.
I don't. Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember the test though. I always, cause you know, I always felt like, it was interesting to me because I was always an endurance athlete, right? And running and rucking and biking was my thing. And then one of the big assessment pieces was that round robin, you know, of all those different things. And I literally had to change my body, you know, cause even like take the run. I don't remember what it was. I think the run, you got an extra point for like every 10 seconds or something like that, but you would get like 2 points for every extra pull up. So it was like, dude, running 10 seconds faster, or let's say a minute faster, you got 6 points. Well, that's like two or three pull ups, you know? So I changed my body. I went from weighing about 160, 165 to probably gaining about 10 pounds of upper body muscle because they were just measuring something different, you know?
Yeah, but you still.
And now I like to add a 10 pounds every couple of years now just to, you know, just to be real. Keep it real.
You still ran the 5 miler in like 21 minutes though or something just silly.
Crazy.
Not quite that fast, but yeah, but you couldn't. Yeah, it was hard to make some extra time. Yeah.
I took the full 40 minutes. 39 exactly. And a half. You know.
Exactly.
Well, Jeff, how are you doing, sir, man? It's so, so good to see you, man.
It's crazy, man. You know, like these, I mean, just time, right? Like I've just got home. I was on this I think it was only 2 weeks kind of tour and talking to people and people, I never get used to the introduction, you know, where they talk about your bio and what you did. And like I sit there and I'm like, well, who are they talking about? You know what I mean? Because in my mind, it's still, you know, way back. Like, hey, we were just trying to make it, you know, now it's in the rearview mirror. Mm-hmm. I did an event a couple months ago. I think it was back in October where, it was for a military thing. And I bought those tiny little medals that you put on your, you know, you wear them with the suit. And again, dude, it's just like, man, it seems like a different life.
Oh,
you
like
know?
The ribbons of the awards that we had.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So like, you know, you bust out your old dress uniform and you look at it and you're like, oh, I remember doing that. I remember doing that. I remember doing that. But at the time you're not really proud of it. You just want to, you just want to make it, you know?
Yeah. Just keep up. Yeah.
Exactly.
Get it on your uniform, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we kind of have an outline, Jeff, and with you, it's just perfect because you are someone who seeks to know who Jesus is. Answer the question with your life of who is Jesus? Like, that's what this podcast is about. And that's what you're doing, man. And, so we have kind of a format for the first time. We're going to just like 1, 2, 3, like to talk about God, who Jesus is to you. Some questions in there. And then 2, you and your family, some questions there. And then 3 will be your book, which is just incredible. And the work you're doing now at Skull Games and, the future, what you want to see in the future. So, Jeff, who is Jesus to you?
But you know, I think it's interesting where I was just at church yesterday, and the pastor was we were in Ephesians, and Paul was describing the early church as the way. It used to be called the way, right? Like, I don't even, you know, all these different words. And it really, I think about that sometimes. And to me, that's what Jesus, Yeshua, he did. He showed us the way. So obviously he's our Redeemer. He paid for our sins, but it's more than just that. He showed us how to live. He showed us the way to live. And I think as I've gotten older, in some of the things that I write about in the book, you know, as a kid, I was impressed on how he could take pain, right? Like how he could endure pain and the sacrifice that he made. And as I've gotten older, like we talked about earlier, you and I can take pain. You know, I can take pain. Yeah. You know, like I can take physical pain, but it's the betrayal. It's the hardship. Mm-hmm. It's the humility. You know, I think one of the things that blows me away more than anything about Jesus is that he lived for 30 years and really didn't say a thing. Yeah. He was a builder. He was a carpenter. He went to work every day. I don't know how mature his powers were yet. You know, I think there was a transition, you know, when he was baptized and filled with the Spirit and went to the desert and all those things and came back and he began his public ministry with the miracles. But I find a lot more comfort in not the savior of Jesus, because it's like, it's just so natural to me. I've believed that was a truth since I was a little kid, but in how he's lived his life in kind of just this quiet humility and just waited and waited and waited. Cause I feel like, since retirement, I've just been waiting on the Lord. I've asked, you know, I feel like he's asked me to do some things and, I'm doing them dutifully, but man, he's not making it easy, you know? So I look more at, in that gap, Jesus is in the temple, you know, as a young kid, and then we don't hear from him again till Nazareth kicks him out. You know, I'm really interested in that space more than anything right now.
No, that's really interesting. Does your wife, is it Julie, or you call her Jules, but is that a personal name?
No, she goes by Jules. Her name is Julianne. But yeah, she'll she. Oh, dude, that was when Jules was making that stuff. Oh, that's very cool.
That's the one she made.
Oh, and that's going to be what do you call that? The glass, the sea glass. I think that's going to be sea glass, probably out of when we were in Newport or something.
No, yeah. That was actually Cam.
My daughter
gave it to Dave.
Had the stone.
Oh, is that what it was? Sure, she did.
Yeah.
Oh.
She wrapped it in the metal so that it Jules could be did. Like that. Yeah. And like that was our thing. So Cam, my daughter, like went to Florida with her mom, divorced, horrible. And like we had that. And it hung on my rearview mirror for like, I'm like, till she turns 16 and gets her own car. And she did. And she just had it. And I just pulled it off her car for this so I could show it to you. But,
dude. Yeah. How old is Cam now?
She's 18.
Oh my gosh! I know. Jeez, right? That's again one of those things. I think of her as a little girl in a car seat. You know,
yeah, exactly. Man, so when we get talking like that, I get lost. But so I'll stay on script here. Your family was Jules. It seems like there's some really deep religious background on your side or her side. Is there?
On my side, there was. So Jules' family is ethnically Jewish. But they came from Eastern Europe, like so many, escaping, you know, the fall of Eastern Europe and the rise of Nazism and all that. But they were secular Jews. And conversely, I was baptized as an infant, as a Wisconsin Lutheran. I went through private school all the way, you know, all the way through high school. I went to Lutheran school. So I was taught that these stories were real and true. And I never really doubted them. And to this day, I've never really doubted them, you know, and I'm envious of folks that look at their conversion, you know, like these born again Christians are like, on this day, Jesus came to me. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I think Jesus came to me when I was a little baby, you know, mm-hmm. and I didn't understand it. And he's walked by my side. And, when I met Jules, we were working together at a restaurant. We were teenagers. I think we were 15. Aww. And, we weren't like romantically in, you know, like we were just friends. To me also, like to date someone outside of being a Lutheran, like I, that just didn't happen. Like everyone at Wisconsin Lutheran High School dated people from Wisconsin Lutheran High School, you know. Jules was a pagan. She went to, you know, she went to the private high school. And I remember one night after work, I don't remember how it started. Maybe it probably started when we were cleaning up before work ended. And I was talking about something about Jesus or Noah or Moses or something like that. And Jules said, wait a minute, like you, do you believe those stories are true? And I'm like, well, what do you mean? Yeah, they're true. And she said, so there was a guy like, so Jesus was real. Like he lived, oh, wow. You know what I mean? Like Moses was real. Like he lived. I'm like, yeah. Like even from a historical point of view, like yeah. it's not really a debate. Like these are historical characters, you yeah. know, like, you know, Julius Caesar lived, you know, Alexander yeah. the Great yeah. lived. And she was blown away. And then I was conversely blown away where I'm like, how is this young lady who's a more ethical, moral person than I am, doesn't even know that Jesus was real or these Bible stories were real. So somehow this discussion extended into her red Dodge Colt outside in the parking lot. And we were talking, I was just telling her these stories that were all very real to me. And she's blown away. She's like, I had no idea. And I had never met anyone who had no idea, oh. right? So what ends up happening, maybe we close down at 10 o'clock at night or something. Well, by 11 or 11:30, her dad pulls into the parking lot. And the windows of the car are all fogged up because it was winter in Wisconsin. And he pulls up.
Just from talking.
And obviously, I mean, it clearly looked like we were making out or being, you know, doing something. And he walks up and he knocks on the window and Jules rolls it down. And yes, we were clothed. You know, there wasn't any scramble. You know, we hadn't started dating yet. But she was like, Dad, nothing happened. We're talking about the Bible. And he's just like,
yeah,
uh-huh, come home. You know, so that was my first encounter with Jules' dad, Pete. And that was my first encounter with talking faith with Jules and just again being blown away and almost embarrassed on how there are people out there that aren't religious. They don't follow the way and yet they live more like Jesus than so many of us that profess to be believers. It's just, it makes me sad.
I can totally relate to that, Jeff. I was raised Catholic, but a very unusual Catholic background, I think. I was told all the stories, but I didn't believe them. And like you were talking about coming to faith, I was 45, I think. And I had that background, but I can tell you the moment that it happened and when everything became real. So I can totally relate to Jules on that, like in a sense. But I think that's really interesting. And not to like morph into something different, but I had asked Dave a long time ago, I said, how can you guys be operators and do the things you do being Christians? And at the time it didn't make sense. Once I've come to know Jesus, it does. I don't know if you want to talk anything about that. Cause Dave and I have talked at length about, you know, it's the only way you could do the job that you did.
It's this interesting question, Laura, and I just came from Columbus, Georgia, and spoke to some of these classes, these young lieutenants that are coming through. Oh, wow. And it came up somewhere else with folks, and there's a lot of young people wrestling with that. How can you be a soldier and a follower of Jesus? You know, this idea between murder and righteous killing and all of this. And there's a lot of young people that are really conflicted because of where our country's stance. And also they look at the wars, like were Iraq or Afghanistan righteous wars? I don't know. We lost them. Yeah. You know what I mean? Did I fight them as righteously and ethically and morally as I possibly could? Yes, I did. Do I feel the same way about the men and women we worked with? Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, and then even this idea how we're divided politically, like, oh, how could I follow this president? You know, and I had this discussion with a lot of these young people and I'm conflicted because it's like, hey, one, it was an insight into their thinking. I never thought that way. I never cared who the president was. You know, right. Like I swore an oath to the Constitution of the United States. Now, again, included in that oath is obeying the officers above you, including the president. But I swore an oath to the Constitution, which is about freedom and liberty.
Amen.
So I don't know how much of these kids are hiding behind this. You know what I mean? Like, they kept talking about these geostrategic stuff and, you know, Iran and China. And I was like, dude, you're a second lieutenant. Learn the 7-8. You know, PMCS your vehicles. You know, when I, you know, as a lieutenant colonel, when I go down to your motor pool, I want to see clean vehicles.
Right.
You know what I mean? Why are you talking about Iran and China and what the, you're like, dude, know your lane. So I think, you know, and honestly, that this is that bridge that I'm making as a believer, like what's my lane? I'm a soldier, man, you know, and Jesus, the Bible never denigrates soldiers. Jesus was friends with the centurion. He never says pick a new line of work.
Right.
You know, Dave, I don't know about you, but man, anytime I went overseas to Afghanistan or Iraq, I read a lot of Old Testament. I just could relate to Old Testament. The New Testament seemed a little further away.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I know where you're going with that, but still, it's like Peter sliced off the dude's ear. He had a sword. Jesus said, put it away. He didn't say, don't have a sword. You know what I mean? So,
yeah,
it's not about, is it okay or is it not? It's about, that's why we do this podcast. It's like, who is Jesus? Because what you just said, he doesn't say that much. Soldiers, be content with your pay. You know, it's like, don't loot. Don't, you know, go nuts with it. So, In what's not said in the Bible, a lot is said.
Hmm. Yeah, I agree. And I think I've never hated our enemies. You know, I've gotten angry a couple times. I can almost count on my hand how many times I was actually angry, you know what I mean, on target.
Right.
On one single hand. Otherwise, I never hated. I never had anger. Like those people chose their position. I chose my position. And maybe this is a cop-out. Where I let God sort it out. You know what I mean? You know, like just like I deal with my life. Hey, I believe God's in charge. Like if you believe God's in charge, why are you wringing your hands over where you are at this point in time? You know, and I'm holding a rifle and I'm about to squeeze the trigger. If God's going to allow that person on the other end of my sights to die, then that's it. And then he'll be ushered to the footstool of Jesus for judgment. You know, I don't believe, and I guess that's part of my faith. I don't believe you're already predestined, right? Like, if you don't follow Jesus and you die, I don't think you're cast immediately to hell. I think you go before the footstool of Jesus and you plead your case and he tells you the truth and then you make a choice from there, you know? And I think even you and I, Dave and Laura, it's going to be the same. You know, he's going to explain to us, you know, whatever it was we got wrong. Oh, hey, you thought this, but it's really this. Do you accept that? Oh, yeah, 100%. You know what I mean? And that's where I feel like, and this is my logic, if people think about it or not, if you're headed on a path into a faith that takes you away from Jesus, the faster I get you off that path, the better you are. And that might include ending your life.
That's really
wow. Yeah.
40 years of developing pride and earnestness and convincing yourself that this path is true versus, you know, 1 year of it. So in many ways, again, you call it logic and people may call BS on it, but in many ways, I think I'm doing you a favor. You know, I'm putting you in front of Jesus as a young man and you get to make that choice to follow him right then and there.
Yeah. And you're so bold in your book, man. Like I just, when I started, I listened to it first. I'm glad you did it. You recorded it. Cause it's like, man, I used to just drive in at freaking 4 a.m. with this guy. And now I'm listening to the same stories, but you're so bold, man. You talked about the 2-star, you don't have to name them. Like, you know, I went
or
up against,
even, I'm sorry, hun, to interrupt, but, or even the chapter where you were talking about the guy holding the baby and he was going to slit the baby's throat and you're like, was I bluffing? I thought that exactly. I'm like, is he bluffing or is he not bluffing? And, you know, and then that kind of brought me back to the thing again, being a Christian and how can you possibly make a decision like that? Or,
well, it's so much more than life and death. Jesus is the way. Like that's bigger than even life and death.
Right, right. And that's why I was like, it is bold. I love it.
Because God sees everybody as alive. He's the God of the living, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. My brother passed away 12 years ago. He's alive to God. Like learning that helped me a lot. God sees everybody.
I think, Laura, that writing process I learned also. You know what I mean? Like I was angry at that two star. But again, I was angry that he treated me like a punk. You know what I mean? That he treated these other sergeants major, you know what I mean, and warriors like punks. I was angry about that. And you know, in that writing I began to realize, you know, I think he was scared. I don't think he was recognizing how he was punking us all out, but I also can give him the benefit of the doubt if he was seeing things from a different perspective. You know, he recognized that, hey, if this two-star general dies on a battlefield in Afghanistan, that's a huge event. That's a historical event.
Yeah.
So again, I would love nothing more than to have a discussion with this guy. I would love to get on a stage and sit there and tell our versions of the story. And he tells what he was thinking. I tell what I was thinking. But the thing is he has to be honest.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's
he has to be honest and say, yep, I was scared for my life. I was in over my head. Dude, got it. Done.
Yeah.
No, nothing, you know, no more said. And then even that same one with that child. And one of the reasons I wrote the book was there's so many of our folks that are wrestling with things and we can't really put our finger on it.
Yeah.
And just writing some of these stories, because I did come to the realization, you know, when I put that uniform on, when I go through that ritual of becoming a soldier, I don't throw away all my morals and ethics.
Right.
But I'm there to bring justice swiftly for, you know, whatever it takes. And honestly, I didn't care about the baby at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Like he was, that was his move. And I'm like, dude, you misunderstood. You miscalculated. You think I care about that kid? I don't.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's a guilt and a shame that I have to live with.
Right.
You know what I mean? But once again, I'll have this discussion with Yeshua someday.
Right.
And I can live with it.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess it was, I guess sensitive to me because we just watched that movie last night and I was in tears over it. And it's, you know, Hollywood, but it
Noah,
was
the
story
Noah.
Of Noah, I think 2014, it's really old, but
yeah.
Noah was saying that he had to murder those two babies or kill those two babies because it wasn't God's plan that, you know, humans procreate and that humans were going to live on Earth. And I was like, whoa, where did that come from? You know, and who is he to make that decision in his head unless, you know, he actually heard it from the Lord. But, I don't know where I was going with that, but like
he got it wrong. He was wrong, but God gets it right.
Yeah.
What happens is God's will for them. You know,
but do you hear it quick enough?
Well, he did because he looked at the babies and he saw love. It was a good example.
Yeah.
But
I enjoyed that movie because I think there was there's a Hollywood aspect to it, but there's also a supernatural aspect that I enjoy.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I think, you know, I touch upon it in the book a little bit. I'm going to touch upon it a lot more in the sequel.
Yeah.
It's just the supernatural aspect of those days and how we're going to return to this supernatural aspect. Again, people read Revelation and they've got all this stuff and it's bookended. You have the Old Testament and, you know, and then you have Revelation and that supernatural interaction, that space, you know, that's dividing us in this world from those creatures and from those spirits. That's gonna be wiped away. So yeah, I liked it because I think we think of this too often as, again, do you believe these folks live to be hundreds and hundreds of years?
Yeah.
If you do, how did that happen? Right. You know, that was a different human being. They were genetically different. There wasn't the impurities. You know, like there's, you know, when you read the couple statements about the Nephilim. Do you believe that happened? Do you believe that angels came down and procreated with human women? And what happened?
Yeah.
You know, so you know, there's all these things that I kind of avoided in the first book because I didn't want people to think I was batshit crazy.
You know what I mean?
But I'll lay it out there in the second one.
Well, tonight, every Monday night, we have a men's theology meeting at my church, and we're doing Unseen Rome.
Oh yes,
and we're like a third in. almost halfway into it. And it is an awesome group. There's guys from other churches in the area. You know, we're in Pinehurst. And it's like silent. Me and, you know, my pastor and a couple guys are pretty well read, and I've been to seminary. So, but I mean, this is a whole nother podcast. We can't go too deep, but you and I talked about it a little bit.
Yeah. And that'll be book two. I mean, the stuff Michael Heiser's written and again, that opened my eyes. Like when you read that phrase of, the angel, I think it was Michael. I don't remember who's like, "Hey, I was on my way, but I got held up. I had to fight the Prince of Persia and now I'm here." Yeah. And like, okay, you can just blow through that as some, you know, poetic discussion in the Old Testament, or you can pause and go, "What's he talking about?" Like you know, and then this idea of these small g gods that Yahweh allowed to exist also begins to make sense on this promised land, and how he took Israel and he set Israel aside and said, "That's mine. There's a prince of Persia, there's a prince of this, there's a prince of that, but no, exactly. This little country right here, this is mine." Yep. Like those things begin to make sense.
Yep.
And good for you, for your church, for tackling that, because I have yet to hear a church talk about this kind of wazoo stuff.
Well, and it's caused some ripples. You know, my pastor, we've gone through a lot lately. Laura was chair of the council, and now I am, and I am so proud of him for taking it on. It's like, wow, and admitting, because he had just preached last year on Psalm 82, and, you know, it's just, oh, they're just wooden idols. Like, no, man, Elohim says in the Elohim, it's just the Hebrew right there. It's as clear as can be.
Yeah.
Other created gods. And we're going to take their place. Like, we are going to be the fam. Psalm 22, that starts out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Pivots to, I will proclaim, Jesus is saying, I will proclaim God's name to us, those who believe in him and follow the way. It's just incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. Jeff, so I'm up to my eyeballs on that stuff right now, Dave. We'll have another discussion
That leads right into identity. Like, have you adjusted for, I don't know how else to say it, your identity from squadron effing commander in Defo, of which there's three or four in the damn world. Like, man, I'll touch on that at the end, but like, good Lord. We just did the last podcast. I was like, there's one, maybe one. I'm trying to think of a second. Okay, Mark Ray, Bill Dean, and you, dudes that are humble, which it doesn't mean what people think it means. It means trusting God and others with your life, laying it out there, putting the damn quickie saw on your back when we're going to rope 90 feet. And gosh, man, I don't know how to articulate how much respect and freaking adoration I have for you. Like borderline, you know, man crush type stuff. But I just, it's like whatever, here, I'm going to put this up right now. You remember that picture I sent you with your book above Jeff Bezos? I'm putting that up right now. And you got 5 stars and he's got 4. That's up. Yeah. I love it.
Jeff versus Jeff.
So that's a good segue to go backwards, you know. So, you know, pride is something that I've always really been careful on trying to guard myself against, because I mean, that is the sin, right? That's it. That's the sin that precedes sin, but again, you have those moments, you know. When the book came out and I got my first 4-star rating, I was like, "Oh man, somebody gave me a 4-star." You know what I mean? And then, you know, and like my pride was hurt. I was mad. I was like, "Who is this person? I want to talk to them." You know, and then you learn to deal with it. And then somebody, you know, maybe a month or two ago, somebody gave me a 1-star, and I was like, "Who?" You know what I mean?
I want to know who that is.
Yeah, and then again, my mind's like, "Oh, well, they probably made a mistake. They didn't mean it." You know what I mean? So again, like I'm not immune from pride, right? Like right. I look at comments, and you know, you look at this stuff, and even in the unit, you know, as you're getting, you know, passed over for something or something you deserve, or, you know, all these types of things. But I'll tell you, man, I just felt it was easier to just live your faith than speak your faith, you know, and you can think of a few folks that we had that got into higher positions in the organization. And man, they sure spoke a lot about their faith, but they lacked mercy. They lacked grace. the ambition and pride, yeah. those are interesting bedfellows. So I found it easy just to, dude, it's easier to just walk your walk.
Yeah. And they become idolatry. They become something you worship. You're going to worship something, right?
Yeah.
And is it God or is it
money, position,
power, something you think you are? Like, that's why I'm talking about identity. I was never one to like think about identity, but in seminary, I realized I was shifting from Delta Force operator, which needed to be, that was my fallback.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anywhere at the hardware store, somebody's trying to, like, do you know who I am? Laura, tell him. Remind him that I'm an operator. That's such crap. I mean, not real, I'm exaggerating, but to, you know, adopted son of God, and my big brother is Jesus Christ. Like, that's my identity now.
Yeah, and even that. So, you know, I never took a squadron, Dave. I got I ended up taking some other jobs, and that was part of it. That was the struggle. I think it was in 2012, 2013. There's discussions at the unit level. Hey, you're ready for a squadron. Here's what we're going to do. This is what we need you to do, kind of a thing. And it was this combination of recognizing where my boys were at in their life, where Jules was at with her life and her health. And then I ended up getting that job in Israel, and I took that, and that was, you know, that's where I made that. That was one of those places, just like you're saying, where I started to shed that skin of that identity as an operator, you know, and I, you know, my identity was an operator more than it was an officer. You know what I mean? Like that was an additional duty, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
But if you're paying attention, God has his ways of recalibrating you. You know, I remember, time my boys were playing soccer. They were probably 10, 11 years old, something like that. And the coach said, hey, can you fill in? And he had to go somewhere. It's like, hey, can you fill in and run this practice? And dude, those kids didn't listen to me. I mean, and I like in my head, I'm like, do you guys, I'm a lieutenant colonel in the Delta Force. Can you not line up? Can you not, you know what I mean? But it strips you away of like, what is true leadership? It's not the rank on your collar.
Yes,
you know what I mean? What is true team building? How do you build trust in people? And to me, that was always the important thing, was building trust in my subordinates. And what was interesting, Dave, is sometimes that cut came at a cost for building trust with your superiors, because you would challenge them as you're representing the guys that you're supposed to be representing.
Yeah.
And you share that with a boss, somehow that would get translated into, you're not doing exactly what I say, so I don't trust you. I mean, I had a unit commander tell me in the face and say, I'm going to give you this assignment. You're going to go do this thing, but I don't trust you.
Wow.
And I said, can we speak candidly? He said, yes. I said, I don't trust you because you speak one way and you act another. Oh. And if you can point to a place where I'm speaking one way and acting another, then I think you're valid in your mistrust, you know?
Oh, I love it.
Wow.
So yeah. Anyway, we won't name names. You probably can guess it.
Hey, let's tell a war story real quick. Did you know I was in 175 when you were? I don't know if I talked about that.
No, I do remember. Well,
remember this?
So,
remember this?
Yeah, dude, you still have that thing.
Yes.
Man, I wish I would have held on to that. 30, I think, I, yeah.
34 years.
Dude.
You need to explain what it is, hon.
He knows what it is.
Not to him. People listening.
Oh, yeah. Oh. That's right. We have 7 listeners.
All 7 of you. Wait, one of them went to the bathroom. Wait for him to come back.
The thing is, we don't care. This is humility because we're trusting God. And this is a helmet, I don't know, cover that we made last minute. I don't know about you guys, Jeff and Aiko, but it was like, hurry up, tear up some BDUs and tie them to some 550 gut. What? And tie them on your heads. Okay. So we did. And it was actually really cool because we all look like predators.
Yeah, I thought it was cool. I don't know why we didn't keep doing it.
All right, it was cool. Awesome. Yeah, Takumin Torrijos, your story is awesome in the book. You were a corporal. I was an E2 ammo bearer. And Biko.
Yeah, but dude, remember going to the airfield and they had the sandbags of stuff? They're like, whatever you do. So, hey, team leaders over here, ammo bearers, and they're handing you stuff you've never even seen before.
Yeah.
Remember?
Yep.
I mean, Laura, you wouldn't believe it. It's like you open it up and it's like, what is this? Oh, this is a Russian hand grenade. Oh, what is this? This is a thermal, not thermal bearer, whatever the ones that burned, you know what I mean? Phosphorus.
Yeah, incendiary. It's
just like, what? Incendiary, yeah.
You might need this. Yeah.
Yeah. You're handing me stuff I've never used before to go into combat. Does that make sense to anybody?
Yep. I'll take that low rocket and the Belgian hand grenades. And then you're 110 pounds, right?
Yeah. Dude, do you remember how much ammo you humped in as an ammo bearer? You must have been loaded.
I had 700 rounds.
Okay.
That's 60-some pounds.
Of ammo alone.
Of ammo. Then there's everything else. Like the tripod that weighs 19 pounds.
Yeah.
Well, it explains the back surgeries and everything else being broken.
Oh, yeah. And 500 feet, 480,
Yeah.
Taking fire. I was on chalk one. Pop, 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 pop.
I don't remember that discussion. What I do remember was in your break in service, I was at 275 when we went to they were given the Black Berets. You had a private protest about the Black Beret, and I remember reading about that in the paper. And it was a dude from 175, and I didn't I didn't know you at the time, but I remember talking about that with you on one of those drives in. Yeah,
that's why I could relate to you talking about the 2-star, because I had it. E5 had a to do with the 4-star, man, and that went well. Like I went to DC. Yeah, we walked 700 miles. Yeah. Hold another podcast, but yeah, with Black Beret, Tan Beret, it's good to question authority, not just to do it, but in order to recognize authority, right? You sometimes have to question it. Like the Centurion clearly knew. He had the great – I always wondered why Jesus said, I have not seen faith like this in all of Israel. It's because he recognized the authority of the Son of God.
Yeah, yeah. I just when I was in Georgia last week, I was actually able to talk at a church, and it was on the woman with the 12-year bleed.
Yeah,
and it's that same thing where she has this faith. So they believe she lived in Caesarea Philippi, which is a day's walk down to get to Capernaum where Jesus was. She can't touch anybody. If anyone touches her, she makes them unclean. So again, like, was she moving at night? She's sneaking her way, and then she's in this crowd of people, like making them all unclean. You know what I mean? Like hoping nobody recognizes her. And then she has the audacity to touch just Jesus' tiny little tassel. Oh. But then again, Dave, it's one of those things where it says, and Jesus felt the power go out of him. That's on my list of stuff. Like, what do you mean by that? Like, what did you, and then the flip side is Jesus is like, who just touched me?
Yep.
And the disciples are total sass. Yep. They're like, what do you mean? Like you're in a crowd of people. What do you mean who touched me? Right. So even the disciples walking around Jesus, like they took him for granted.
Yeah.
They thought he was saying something ridiculous, like that right. Brings me comfort also when I have those moments where I'm like, come on, God, what are you doing?
Right.
The disciples themselves were like, Jesus, don't be a fool. Everyone's touching you. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. So your sons are now, Jonah and Aaron are how old?
Aaron's 26. Jonah's 23.
No, wait,
yeah.
No.
Yeah, if you can believe that.
No, they were small children.
Both fiancés. Both have fiancés. Ready to, they're already well on their life. Aaron gets his master's degree in performance psychology, I think, the end of the month. Joan is going to be going back for a master's. I don't know in what, leadership or entrepreneurship or something. The 9/11 GI Bill is coming in handy. So I'm like, hey, boys, you don't have to get master's degrees, but you might as well.
Nice. Did they ever want to join the military?
No, it never even dawned on them. I don't know. I mean, I'd be proud if they did. In many ways, I want them to do their own thing. When I was in town in Southern Pines for Aaron Roof's memorial, there was a lot of children that are joining the military, boys and girls. I was absolutely shocked how many operator children have turned around and joined the military. I mean, 20 years of being away from home fighting these losing wars.
Yeah.
And somehow this family, somehow, again, it's mostly men with the wives, somehow they kept enough promise and optimism that their children aspired to move into that.
Yeah, that's why. Was there a discussion? I mean, did they even ever bring your children? Did they ever bring it up ever as a possibility?
Mine didn't either.
No.
Yeah.
Mine don't. I mean, I think
they don't know what you did.
Well, but you've tried to tell them, and one of them like showed up wearing my old Jim Markwell bracelet.
Wow.
I carried Markwell off like the DZ, wrapped him in my poncho. Like they pulled up this truck and said, "Hey, Nielsen and this other kid, unload this truck." We opened the doors and it's like full of bodies.
Dude, what's interesting. Did you get there early with his firefight? Were you there for early or was this a little bit afterwards?
It was like 2 hours after everything was calm.
Oh, okay. All right. Because that was one of those where I was interested. It would be interesting if you were there. I ran past that. Mm. So I was moving to the assembly area and I was making that decision of, hey, do they need my help over here or do I need to get to the assembly area and build combat power? And it wasn't until, dude, it was years later that I actually understood what it was that I had run past and had seen, you know?
Yeah. And I remember running past something, but it was my first time. I had been a battalion 3.5 months from RIP. Half the RIPies that came in my class quit that night that we were bravoed. Guys were quitting like, nuh-uh. I had to talk my way on. I'm like, I talk to my old Sergeant Rummels all the time. Like,
he was a friend of mine.
Oh,
Rummels. Man, that dude was a trip. What a good dude.
You should see him now. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Aaron Roof's gone, eh? Wow, I didn't know that.
You didn't?
Nope.
I'm going to break your heart. I'm going to break your heart. It was suicide.
I had a feeling. Hey, man, do you want to say anything about that?
Chronic pain.
Yeah.
You know, the thing, man, I hate to, I don't think so. Okay. Just, I don't want, I mean, we can talk offline. I don't want to share stuff about him. You know what I mean? What I would say because of the podcast we're on, Jesus came to Aaron in his pain. Aaron shared that with me. Aaron suffered incredible chronic pain from that house bomb that landed on the troop. Jesus came to him. So there's no doubt in my mind, like people, suicide is not the end. You know what I mean? Again, Laura, as a Catholic, right? The ultimate sin, suicide. No, it's not. Yeah, God understands. You know what I mean? God understands. We're going to see Aaron again.
That's how I lost my brother. So yeah.
Yeah.
But I'd like to, since we're here, I want to tell you this. I don't think I have. I feel like the last time I saw you was at Ben's funeral.
Oh.
Was that 2010, 11? My life blacks out there from 09 to 14.
I think it was, it was 10 or 11. I don't remember exactly. Yeah.
But because Jeff, I had come home from Israel, I think, from language school. And all I remember, the only person I remember there is you, because we were in OTC with Ben. You were in A squadron with Ben. I was in C. I just remember you at that funeral, and I wrote something about it, like, because there was a line, you know, we were all around him. And then his sons and wife Heather walked back, when they looked at me, I will never, ever, ever forget that look. And it changed my life. And it's when I decided to went to medically retire and get out of the army.
Really?
But I just want to say that you talking about leadership, like, I just remember you, and I don't even know what we said, but it was like, okay, Boss Teagues is here. I'm good. Like, I don't know what it was. It was some stupid peer pressure that's always there, but I don't even know, man, something, but, thank you. Ben was awesome.
Well, thanks for sharing that, man. You know, I don't, you don't know what you're doing. You know, it's the one cool thing of growing older, other than your body falling apart, is you get to hear some of these things where you impacted people's lives that you didn't even know, you know. And I see some of these, I talk to some of these men who are like, oh no, dude, like, you know, you introduced me to Jesus, you introduced me to the Bible, or you made it true. And I don't even remember, you know? And I think that's what believers should do more of. Just walk your walk, man. Be kind, be truthful, you know?
Yeah.
Stop trying to whatever, proselytize and change people's opinion, and stop being so judgy.
Yeah.
You know?
And share those experiences with each other. You know, that you did change my life. You did introduce me to Jesus. You did, you know, it matters.
Yeah.
It's what it's all about. So, Jeff, will you tell us about Skull Games?
Yeah. So this, around this same time, it was 2013-ish when I was making those decisions. Again, it was this magic combination of, I was beginning to see, okay, if I stay in and take a squadron, this is what's expected of me. You know what I mean? And so it's a 4 or 5 year commitment, right? Like, what's expected of you when you get rewarded with that command, and how old my boys would be. And Jules was having some health issues. And quite honestly, the job was in many ways not interesting to me to for that sacrifice, you know, the troop command, team time, you know, all these small unit leadership is what I was really into, you know, where you're not this figurehead, you know? And I ended up finding a singleton job in Israel that was a straight up CT coin, you know, job, counterinsurgency job, that I was literally a singleton working on. Mm. And the family was able to come to Israel and do that. And then I was able to come back afterwards and spend a final year working some special projects at the unit, you know, which I'm really proud of. And as in that movement, you know, I was trying to think, what do I do next? What do I love? You know, I love building teams. I love small unit tactics. I love the ops intel integration. I think we'd learned a lot. You know, I feel like we've lost so much of that. Again, these discussions I'm having with lieutenants are all like that. The geopolitical strategic level, it's like, no, do you guys understand ops intel fusion? Do you understand how to collect? Do you understand how to create NAIs and RFIs and change assumptions to facts? Like, do you guys understand how to do your job? Like, stop talking about Trump and Biden and the Secretary of State, you know? Right. And I think we mastered that at the tactical level. Mm. But we also knew what we did at the tactical level has strategic repercussions. I thought that was what was fascinating about the jobs that we did, you know, like if you miss, if you've got something wrong here, that will have a strategic implications on U.S. policy. Mm. I like that kind of pressure.
Yeah.
But I loved that relationship. And I think, I built really close relationships with our intel folks. I mean, you know, so many people think of the assaulter and the operator, but man, just as what, if not more of what makes the unit what it is, are those enablers. We have the best admin folks. We have the best mechanics. We have the best cooks. We have the best veterinarians. We have the best, you know, we have the best everything. And our intel folks were incredible. So God, at one point, it was 2011. I remember I was on a run and he kind of spoke to me and said, hey, I want you to look at this thing called sex trafficking. I want you to protect and defend these women and children that are being exploited in the United States. I'm like, what? What are you talking about? I didn't know what it was. I started to study it and really, really began to feel committed to it. And what's interesting, Dave, I'm not going to name names, but there was two guys in the unit similar to me. We were officers. We were all in that same position in life that had the same exact word spoken to them.
Wow.
I would argue to say it at the exact same time. I remember going for a run with one of them a couple days later and saying, hey man, last week God came to me and he asked me to do this. And he was like, so did I. Okay. You know, so there was some definite, you know, hey, this is what I'm asking you to do. So I started studying it. I started to think, hey, how does the F3EA process, fix, finish, exploit, analyze, you know, how does that work against counter trafficking? Who, you know, and, you know, we redefined it, you know, to what we do now specific to, in the United States. But it was such, it's a really a one for one overlay. our host nation partner is law, is domestic law enforcement instead of being an Iraqi force or Afghan force or pick a nation force. So I think everything that I did in the military was prelude to this. I just greatly underestimated the budget. You know what I mean? I knew that I could go into any country in the world and develop a team of pipe hitters, partnering with the host nation, the intel enablers we needed. I knew I could do that like that. But I didn't really appreciate how much Uncle Sam was footing the bill. And that's been the struggle, for 8 years in doing this, we have the answer to counter commercial sex trafficking in the United States, hands down. We figured it out. I've been perfecting it. It's just budget. And again, it's one of those things where I'm going back to where we first started. I continually ask God, I was like, hey man, like you asked me to do this, you didn't even ask her. It was more of a tasker. You tasked me to do this. Like, where's the budget? Can you help with the budget at all?
Lord God, I come before you right now and ask for budget for this book that you wrote, Jeff, Where Have All the Heroes Gone? God, you told me to answer that, and stand up one at a time. So here's one and two, and we are answering that, Lord God. And you, of course, are the original, the way, Jesus. So I ask in your name for the budget for this to protect your little ones, Lord God. In your name, Jesus, amen.
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 Jeff, yeah, I feel like I want to, reading your book, it was like, I was like, Laura, this is what I've been trying to do all these years, because I started it like 40 times. And I'm like, he did it. And he did it really well. Yeah. I don't need to do it again. Maybe I could just answer it. So that's where I'm at now. But man, the structure is just freaking perfect.
Yeah, it's great. And it's not, just military. Anybody can read it and get it. You explain it all so well. And I even appreciated that. I was at the unit and there were a lot of things that I didn't know. I stayed in my pod up on the hill. But yeah, it was...
Shoot around the kids. I love that. I had many of those instances. I was the guy getting the calm, troop commander saying, yeah, shoot around the kids, just as cool as can be.
Well, it's, yeah. And, I appreciate again coming from you guys, because you were there and our culture is we don't write books, right? Mm-hmm. And there's plenty of guys that are, that's black and white. You don't write books, period. I felt that there was a gray area in there. You can write books if you do it correctly. You know what I mean? But that event too of Shoot Around the Kids, that was one of those where I wrestled with, and I don't remember exactly how I talk about it in the book, but I remember even more of like, look, it looked like this is either going to be an abort or we shoot around the kids. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like we're coming in hot and this is the situation we're dealing with. And I remember asking, again, I'm not sure if it's in the book or not. I remember asking team leaders, hey, how do you guys feel about shooting around the kids? Can you do it? And they were all like, just thumbs up.
Yeah. You said something about it. Either you knew or you actually talked about it. Yeah.
Right.
And then they did it, dude.
Yep.
Yeah. The way it's written, it's not like willy nilly. Hey, John Wayne, shoot around the kids. It was done very well in the unit fashion. Like nothing is just, thrown out there for people that don't know. It's not, everything is, decided with skill. It's not
just that phrase, the hilarity isn't the right word because it's not funny, but the absurdity of it.
Yeah.
Like we're actually saying this and we're going to do it.
Yeah. And that you can do it.
Yeah. And that's, again, it's really nice talking to you guys because you were there. And it's like, on one hand, people that walk the halls of the unit, they're just people. Like there's nothing special about them. And yet I don't even know, like that is the most impossible thing to do. Like we're moving in a helicopter, shooting a moving vehicle, and you're shooting around children. That's nearly impossible.
Yeah.
And they make it look like it's just, but here again, I forget. I need to reread. I don't think I talk about this in the book, but but now the flip side is, and I think where I don't know where, but looking at counter arguments, counter intuition kind of a thing. So this is dovetails a little bit when it comes to the pride discussion that we had, where I began to ask them to do that, not regularly, but more than, again, the first time was the hard one, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know if I've ever talked to you about this. I don't think it's in the book, but I equate it to, remember the movie The Naked Gun when Leslie Nielsen is the catcher?
Yeah.
And he's looking for something and the dude whips the ball and he's not paying attention. Everyone waits for him to call strike, you know, and he's like, strike, and the crowd goes wild. You know what I mean? And then this, everything he's calling strike for everything and he's dancing and it's just a hilarious, but that's almost how I began to feel. Like I was so comfortable, like calling everything a strike. You know what I mean? Like, I had to like consciously like pause and say, hey man, have you lost your filter? Like, is everything a strike? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But Dave, I go back to, it was, you know, like the situations that we were in and you know, probably one of the proudest things that I've got, you knew the troops that I ran and dude, we fought as hard, if not harder than anyone else. And I never lost a guy, you know, I never even had guys get scuffed up. I had people criticizing what you're doing. Dude, is everything a strike? Yes, it is. You know, apparently, you know,
you guys,
but
were
the proof is in the pudding, you know?
My whole team got shot and blown up several times, except me. And I was like, at that point in my life, you knew my ex, like I was ready to die. Like,
yeah,
what do I got to do? Like I was the first guy in every time, pop, 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 you know, like you guys suck at shooting. I'm right here.
Yeah. Yeah. I know.
But I'm not proud of that. I'm just saying like, you know, God got me through that. I needed to look back at and realize that. And this fine woman here, Laura, just helping me through that identity. Like it was an identity thing. I needed to, prove, I realize now the reason I went to the unit, and I don't know if you can relate, but I needed to do everything, the manliest thing possible so that no man could tell me, well, you don't understand this. Like that's really why I did it, so that I could really believe in God, because I don't know. It's like, I need to check the block. And I did. And then it was like, what next? For me, it was just, you know, high up in a team, as high as I wanted to go and still be able to do the job. But then what? Like,
yeah,
a lot of people get there to that point. Then what?
Theology.
Yeah, exactly. Hopefully people find God, you know, because you've reached the highest pinnacle of sacrifice and professionalism with, I mean, the most, I mean, it's the most incredible organization on the planet.
Yeah.
And yet it's broken. It's full of sinful humans. And like this is as good as it gets, like, you know, and I think that going back to what you were saying too, it's one of these things that folks have a hard time understanding is yes, at some point in our lives, you just come to the fact that I may die doing this and you come to terms with that and everything else just kind of takes second seat.
Right.
You know, and so it's a weird way to live.
Yeah. Your book is cool. You also use the phrase unwinnable wars. And I mean, you've kind of alluded to that already, but Laura, what was your perspective being a unit member, direct support during the wars?
I was intimidated by everybody. I came from regular army. I was 17 years regular army. I didn't even know who the Rangers were or SF. Like when I went to interview, I didn't know where I was interviewing for. So, you know, and then once I learned, I went and watched the Chuck Norris movie so that I'd be prepared. But it's just awe-inspiring the amount of effort and work and support that goes into you guys. Like, of course, you are the men doing it and, you know, putting in the time and the pain and the sacrifice. Now, gosh, looking back, your families, I have so much respect for them. I can't imagine being married to Dave and him leaving like that. I can't imagine just losing your foundation of your family for that long of a period of time and perhaps forever. Like, so, I don't know. It blew me away. I couldn't believe the resources that were spent on training you guys and preparing you for war, but it was necessary. And the, you know, the results speak for themselves that you can shoot around the kids. And so much of it, I didn't understand how much those teeny tiny little details mattered, like every single little detail. So for me, it was just incredibly eye-opening. You know, I'm a kid from Nebraska. I joined the Army to get out of Nebraska. So to see, it's like Hollywood, I guess, you know, like what you think is so important, or I don't know. I don't know how to describe it. It really was.
Well, but Laura was selected too. She, you know, she had to apply like we did, and she was the first vet tech to be hired there. And she was told by her commander, what are you doing? You're a girl. Like, they don't need girls.
Yeah. But even worse than that was when I got there, I said, well, what do you guys want me to do? And they said, do your job. And I'm like, okay.
Do your job right.
Right. And then I learned, you know, I learned that you don't say no. You just figure out a way to make it happen, which I was kind of good at anyway. I was,
yeah,
you know.
But, well, I think you're right. And it is like living in a movie. And some of it's real and some of it's not real, you know? Yeah. And I going back to the Skull Games idea too, where we were talking about going on this unwinnable wars and this idea of you know, like a profession. This is one of the things that I find interesting as a nonprofit is like this is my profession. This is what I do every day. You know, I don't know if folks understand that. I think the nonprofit space, a lot of people do it as a hobby. Like, no, this is a new profession that we've moved into, applying these things that we've learned, you know, and all five of the people that are full time with Skull Games, they're veterans and they're taking what they've learned and they're applying this. And while on one hand, I would characterize, you know, sexual abuse as an unwinnable war, you know, and even commercial sex trafficking as an unwinnable war, but that's not the point. Like, are we fighting or not? You know, and I think even when back in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, I remember distinctly coming to that realization of, hey, we're not going to win these wars, but it doesn't matter to me. My job isn't to win the war. My job is to fight, you know, and even in Afghanistan, I remember the last time I went to Afghanistan, I said to the guys, hey, dudes, you've proved yourself. Like, if you don't want to be here, if you don't want to come, then just come up with an excuse. Mm. You know, it's fine. Like, I got it. Yeah. You know what I mean? But when we're there to fight, you know, and you know, we're not really there anymore to take Al-Qaeda or Taliban or whatever off the battlefield, win a war. We're there to take them off the battlefield because these young sailors and Marines and Army soldiers and Air Force folks that are living here that keep getting chipped away at and blown up and hurt. Like you said, Laura, we're given every asset on the planet. So our job isn't necessarily to win the war. It's to protect these young men and women that our country is still asking them to be there. And if that's not enough for you, then stay home. I got it. Mm. You know, and I had one guy who said, dude, you know, if I deploy, I'm going to come home to an empty house. Mm. You know, my wife and kids will be gone. It's like, look, I got it. Then stay home. And, you know, we found something for them to do. But again, by 2012, you know what I mean? 13, 14, like did guys not prove their courage?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like 10 years of warfare, did they not prove their courage?
I had an eye opener when it didn't actually happen like this, but I wish it had. the two parts of it happened. An officer said, a ranger officer said, you know, anybody can go in there and kill cavemen. And then I thought about it and, you know, it's like, sir, how many cavemen have you killed?
Yeah.
Because it's not easy. It's not natural. Not many people do it. I did it because I chose to do it because I was done catch and release and watching our guys get picked off by somebody who'd been rolled up twice already and seeing the same numbers on top of the rooms. Right. I talked to, you know, my commander and said, hey, are we okay to, you know, you mean kill capture? Okay, then let's get it on. And we did. And not many did that. And I talk about that, Jeff, because it's a big deal. It's a big thing. And it's not at all to brag. I really took my time thinking about this. You understand, to talk, get through my, you know, the process of who is Jesus. That's what it's all about. That's why I'm doing it. And we all do it in a different way. But
well, Jeff. And warfare is a viable means of politics. Again, this Klaus Wittstein idea is an extension of politics. Yeah, it is. Like, warfare still matters, but not the way we've been fighting them of late. You can't half ass stuff. You know what I mean? You can't just go in there and fart around. If war is the decision, and it is the viable decision in some situations, then just win it.
Right.
I mean, it's embarrassing. When I went to the, I don't mean to cut you off. We'll come back to it, Laura. So please don't lose the thought. You know, I went to the Army Museum. There's a brand new Army Museum up in Washington somewhere, Belvoir or whatever those places are. And you follow the history of the United States from, I don't know if it's French and Indian War or that starts at, but Revolutionary War. And you go through and then you get to Vietnam. And you just look at the lengths of these wars. Dude, World War II was 4 years.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
You know, to beat the British and get our independence, what was that, 6 year war, you know, 5-ish year war,
yeah.
You know, and then you get to Vietnam that dragged on, you get to Afghanistan and Iraq that dragged on. And you know, it's like you we're so proud of this history. Sherman's march, just the scorched earth policy to break the back of the Confederacy, you know, the landing on D-Day, we're all in, you know, we're all proud of this Army heritage. And then you get to these wars where you're like, dude, we're just half-assing it. You know what I mean? How did we not win Iraq and Afghanistan? We beat the Axis. We beat the Nazis and the Italians and the Japanese coupled together to take over the world. You know what I mean? Like, how did we lose Vietnam? How did you lose Afghanistan? How did you know what I mean? Yeah. So I was absolutely embarrassed and devastated and thinking, does anyone see what I'm seeing? Mm. Like, does anyone see the shift in how we look at warfare, and it's become a game?
Right.
With rules. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
we didn't win because we had a collectively corrupt heart. I mean,
I think you're right. What were you going to say, Laura? I'm sorry for, yeah.
I'm not quite sure. I made a note after the fact. I didn't understand too at the unit, and this is going back, it's not on the same topic, but it was that not everybody was doing everything. And I think that that's the perception that a lot of people have, like that an operator does XYZ, and that there aren't different positions or different personalities that are like robots or something. I don't know. You know, we all have this picture of, I did even while I was there, of what an operator is and what he does. And, you know, since marrying Dave, I've learned so much more about it that, you know, we are still individuals and we are still, making our own decisions. And, you know, my impression was that everybody was killing and everybody was doing the dirty work, and everybody, you know, and there were a lot of people that along. Didn't. Pardon me?
Everybody got along. And
well, yeah, I didn't know there was man drama. And then I learned it and I was so happy because I was like the only female in my section. I was, you know, I was like, yeah, this is great. I don't have to deal with any of it. But so that was surprising to me that
Well, it's interesting you say that, because one of the saving graces of units like that is that people are older and they you know what I mean, you're expected. And again, I was just at Columbus, Georgia, down at Fort Moore, and you know, having these discussions and these young Rangers and things like that, and this makes a little bit more sense too, Laura, because I'm like, how does someone think a Ranger is an operator? You know what I mean? Like, you and I were Rangers. We were 19, 20, 21 years old. How have we conflated this idea of what a special forces guy does or an operator, even our 18 X-ray program of folks coming into Special Forces. Well, I think the average age of that dude is like 24 or 25. You know, they've got like grad school. They ran a business, you know, like, so now we've made Rangers these tier one forces. And it's like, do they not understand? Like, you need to develop wisdom. It isn't about the tactics or how fast you can do X, Y, and Z. It just takes years to develop this wisdom and this decision making and finding your own identity. You know what I mean? So I don't know. I think we've made some really bad decisions. You know, on top of that too, is even watching, Dave, we were talking about the fitness test at the unit. Dude, how did that not become the Army fitness evaluation? Right. Instead, it's like thousands of pounds of equipment. And it's like, you know, someone sold the Army this bill of goods that you need to be stronger and be able to sprint faster, like you're a tight end on an NFL football team or a running back for an NFL football team. It's like, no, man, you need to be as light as possible, being able to move long distances, because even the hit, you have one tomorrow and the next day and the next day and the next day. And that level of endurance needs to be able to stand. We've sold this false bill of goods. And Laura, I'm going to remember this discussion because it's interesting, because even people who you think are on the inside aren't on the inside.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like the things that you thought were happening that weren't, or vice versa. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, it just like individual PT, you can't let a young Ranger do individual PT. You can't give a young Ranger access to his ammo and his weapon. You know what I mean? Like, you know, you can't expect a young Ranger to go into an embassy and start representing the United States. You know, I don't understand how we've lost this value for seasoning men and women in these operational capacities. It's just, it's lost. And I don't know when we're going to get it back.
Yeah. And the, you know, the unit was so, I felt that the unit was so confident in their selection of people that they gave us mm-hmm. responsibilities that we might not have really been ready for, even with life experience. I think I went when I was 35 or 37. And like, I was given some responsibilities that, you know, you grow up really, really, really fast at the unit. You learn very fast and you spend way more hours than you probably need to. Well, no. You just have to spend a lot more hours than maybe a regular job. But, you know, I was put into positions that had nothing to do with medicine, nothing to do with mm-hmm. canine, nothing to, like, administrative at a very high level. And I was like, you guys have the wrong person. I might be responsible and I might be capable, but, like, I stayed in my pod because there's just – it's overwhelming. Even the language is different. You know,
yeah.
It's not regular Army language.
Jargon, yeah.
Yeah, the jargon.
But like you said, you were 35. I was 36 when I got to the unit. You know what I mean? And I had been a Ranger for, you know, almost a decade. I'd have been an SF guy. It's like you don't get to be 36 without learning and understanding the things that, like you talked about, working in that gray space and that decision making. Remember those few years of being the ultimate problem solver? Yeah, you're just not the ultimate problem solver at 19, 20, 21 years old. No. You know, my son, we talk about Aaron, he's 26 years old. Brilliant kid. Brilliant. But he's 26.
Yeah.
He just hasn't lived enough yet.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, we talk about our niece. She's 25, and she's in a master's program for physical therapy. Like, she's got a huge brain. But again, she's 25, and she knows the Lord. Like, she's a great Christian and very, very mature. But you're right. Like, you need time.
I think the key is suffering well, learning to suffer well. Romans 5, suffering, perseverance, character, hope. Hope has been so big lately. Like, Colossians 1:5 says, faith and love spring from hope. I never gave hope much consideration, but it's so important. And really, when I think back to when I was a little kid, before things went terribly wrong right away, it was hope. It was God telling me that, hey, just go ahead. This is just a big camping trip. Do your best, you know, and we'll link up later. But hope is just so, so important.
And I agree. And I don't want to speak out of both sides of my mouth, because the flip side of that is this new generation, they're going to be fine. You know, and I think even in the Bible, was it Timothy that Paul was talking about, hey, stop judging this guy because he's young. You know what I mean? I don't remember who Paul was talking about. I think it was Timothy. He had, you know, and it's the same with my kids in this generation. I am not the old fuddy-duddy of kids these days. I think kids these days are brilliant.
Yeah.
They're going to be fine. It's a different world than ours, 100%. Yeah. I don't feel that way. And then even when you look at in history, like how old was Thomas Jefferson when he wrote the Declaration of Independence? He wasn't an old man. You know, a couple of those guys were old, but you know, through history, we've had young people, men and women, that were brilliant and capable in their late 20s and 30s. And we're in that weird spot, right? Like on one hand, someone's not qualified or they need to grow up so fast. And anyway, I'm talking very specifically of that seasoned operator. You know, I guess I would maybe parlay that into politics. I don't see how you can be a politician, you know, unless you're a certain age, just understanding the world and living a little bit. I don't understand how you can go from being a bartender or an activist or, you know, work, you know, to being a politician who's making strategic decisions for our nation.
I think the young ones, what I see in them, the best quality is they know that they're clueless. We didn't know.
Mm.
we thought we knew.
Yeah.
Something cool.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm going to flash this picture up. I don't think you can see it, Jeff, but were you in A3 or was it A1 in Desert Storm with Biko?
You confused me there. So Desert Storm, I was Alpha Company 3rd Platoon.
Did you guys deploy with us?
We did, but it was at the end. So it was 1st Platoon that went with you guys early.
Okay.
Yeah. So 1st Platoon was there for months and months.
Okay.
And then we came in for that show of force thing.
Oh, in Kuwait when we jumped into Kuwait.
In Kuwait. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I was there with Biko. I just flashed a picture up because Schwarzkopf was there and everything, and it's just ridiculous. But okay, so that was A1, and then you guys came late. Okay, I gotcha.
Yeah. No, you confused me when you – just the way you were saying it because, with A1 or A3, I was thinking squadron stuff. Yeah. I was 3rd Platoon Alpha Company.
Okay.
That's how we used to say it back in the day, Dave.
Yeah,
3rd Platoon Alpha Company, 1st Platoon Alpha Company, yeah.
When I got there, we had to walk by your barracks, and you guys were all throwing peanuts and whatever you could find at us. I just stayed away, man.
They just had the 50th year anniversary.
Yeah. Rummels called me that night. Lanier, I got a voicemail. I played for Laura. He's like just hammered. Lanier. He called me Lanier for some. You're supposed to be here. Where the F are you?
I wish I'd have known because I was in Columbus. I came home on Thursday. If I would have known about it, I probably would have made the drive over to Savannah. That would have been pretty cool.
We'll let you go here soon. I messed up the screens. I don't know what I did. I keep trying to fix it, but I can't. It's okay. I think we're going to be known for just having a screwy podcast, but that's all right. We'll let you go here, Jeff. I just, where are you at now with Skull Games, and you need more money, right?
So we've built a task force of folks. So everything we're talking about, what you and I did and even understanding of the task force, remember when we created a task force and you would, you know, you'd bless off on these people and they understood how to do it the unit way, et cetera. So that's like, you know, we have the Skull Games way and we've got a task force of volunteers that are so selfless and remarkable and incredible. And they're scattered all across the country. We're going to have another opening in May, where we'll have people apply. We're probably taking about 10% of the people that apply to be part of the Skull Games task force. Again, just they need to understand open source intelligence. They need to understand how we do it. But we're direct support to law enforcement. So we are constantly scouring the sex ads, identifying girls that are being sold online, trying to identify who their traffickers are, and ensuring that the cops get out there and work operations with the right information they need to be successful. And we're doing it in places all over the country, about 30 to 40 different cities we're supporting. I'd say about 10, 12 of them are really, really consistent. But we also know, you know, before I retire a second time, we're going to have to reach this operational tempo where you're having that impact. You know, I don't think the traffickers out there are really feeling the pain yet. You know, there are places where we'll make them run from one city to another. Oh, but you know, there's an op tempo that you need to be able to have regions applying the pressure and watching them squirt and run. So all these things that we recognize, this is all language you're familiar with. We're trying to apply it very specifically to these men that are selling women and children.
I mean, God bless you. God bless you, Jeff. It's so heartbreaking. You know, the world knows how heartbreaking it is. And I don't know how you can do it. I mean, I think it's got to be almost worse than war because it's children. I don't know. But I'm so impressed. And if you need a volunteer to do something, not what you're looking for, but if you need somebody to, I don't know, file stuff, I can do it.
Well, Laura, I appreciate it. You know, I think prayer of covering is always good for everybody. Absolutely. And then like you just prayed for, Dave, I'm waiting for that, for the floodgates to open, you know, and again, the other comfort that I have that people don't think about is the Israelites were in Egypt for 400 years. They were slaves for 400 years. You know, how many times, I mean, that's generations of people going, God, where are you? Mm-hmm. And then Moses shows up, he gets them out of Israel, miraculous things happen. And then they wandered for 40 years before they went back into the promised land. Like that's a long time, you know, and then even the between the Old and New Testament, another 400 years where we talk about this God's chosen land of Israel. He was silent for 400 years. And then John the Baptist shows up, you know. So again, I'm a man, I'm a human, right? I feel I'm impatient. You know, this has been 8 years of trudging that I haven't seen, you know, the fruits of our labor to date. And I'm hoping it doesn't take 40 years, but I know the stories and I trust the stories, and God has told us those stories for a reason. So
that's right. And you and I talked, you said the process is where the things happen. So you're in that process, man. We commend you so much. After this won't be posted for about a week, but if you have, you know, stuff that we can put on the YouTube or Spotify, episodes, you know, for
links.
Yeah. If you anything like that, just send it to us and we'll get it put on there.
And I want to thank you guys both for your encouragement with the book. You know, I knew I was stepping out of bounds in a degree, you know, not, you know, I had the discussion with folks. I said, hey, I'm not happy just to be, you know, what's the legal thing I can do? Or like, what's the cultural right or wrong? You know, and I've had really positive feedback from most folks. Again, both of you, Dave, you're a friend. You were there with me for all of this. You were there, Laura, to see. And, you know, I don't know how we get back to our folks to just help them find some of that healing. So the encouragement that you both have given on this journey, I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
I have a question. This doesn't have to be on the podcast. I was just curious, what's your impression? I won't keep you long. What's your impression of the folks that are really, really suffering? Is it, I mean, to me and Dave, it's because they don't know Jesus. That's why they're like PTSD, and the folks that are really struggling after the war and after the unit. I mean, childhood, of course, plays a huge part of that, you know, how messed up you were growing up and then not knowing Jesus. And I don't know, just the struggle with the job that you did. And I understand how so many people can do it, and, you know, you can make those decisions. I don't know. I'm just curious what your thought is on that. Like, just in general,
yeah.
I'm all over the place.
And I think you answered it in many ways too, Laura. I think it's a combination. Physical pain is heavy.
Yeah.
You know, physical pain leads to emotional and spiritual pain. So even if you know Jesus, physical pain is hard to deal with. And then that, what I don't understand, even when you talk about physical pain, even just that trauma, like what's the difference between PTS and TBI? Like, how are those related? You know, how does brain trauma affect you know, the PTS out of it? How does physical pain? So that's a weird alchemy that I don't think we've begun to understand. So I think there is, what we do know is we've all suffered TBIs just from training, just from what we do, jumping out of airplanes and eating charges and being around guns and all, you know, the things that we did. So everybody has a level of a TBI. How does that equate? So I think it's the physical that ends up turning into emotional and spiritual. I do think there's a huge, maybe not huge, there's a larger proportion of men and women that suffered physical and sexual trauma in our ranks than we recognize. Yeah. It only stands to reason, right, that a young man or woman, like you just said, you said you wanted to get out of Oklahoma. I don't know what your story is, but a lot of people find themselves in the military and at the highest levels of the military because something bad happened to them, and they make the decision, never again, not to me ever again, and not to anyone I love. And they become almost quite literally a superhero. You know, they become super achievers because they were exploited, molested, assaulted, abused when they were children. So I think that trauma begins to leak out with folks that have been able to hold it at bay. I think there's an identity issue. Like you said, all of us have this identity. Just like you said, Dave, you know, there are moments where I feel like I'm being disrespected. And it's like, do you not know who I am? Do you not know what I've done? You know what I mean? Do you not know what I've sacrificed? Again, those come few and far between, but they're there. And I think when somebody kind of lives in that space, it's not healthy. And then really pursuing that next line of passion and purpose. I think it's a huge combo. And then I also think spiritually, you know, if you were an evil spirit that lived in Afghanistan for a couple thousand years, or lived in Iraq for a couple thousand years, or lived in Africa for a couple thousand years, and you had an American soldier coming out there hanging out, wouldn't you want to ride home and come to America?
Yikes.
You know, I think our men and women are bringing spiritual oppression back with them. I think when you kill a human, you're not killing the spirits that are driving that human, you know? Right. So, you know, if you're killing a terrible Al-Qaeda, Taliban, that demonic spirit that is influencing that person lives on. And where does it go? It's going to attach itself to someone else. So I do believe also that Americans have been coming home from these wars, and we're taking ancient spirits home with us. And we don't understand what that's doing to us, because they sit on our shoulder and they talk in our ear. Wow. They tell us we're worthless. They harp on your pride. They harp on your weaknesses. And I think after years of that oppression, people get really lost.
That's really an interesting take. I love that. That's
yeah.
something to think
but
about.
But again, this is that, again, you know, it's kind of crazy where people are like, what are these guys talking about? But look, do you believe in good and evil? Well, what is that? What's good and what's evil? Like you talk about it in some general terms. Is it a thing? Are there good spirits? Are there angels that are good? Are there angels that are bad? Like if the Bible talks about it very, very clearly. Yep. So again, wouldn't it stand to reason if the cradle of civilization has been where we've been fighting? Like those, there's thousands and thousands and thousands of evil spirits. And again, Dave, we saw it. You feel it. I've killed men and seen things leave their body. Mm. Spirits leave their body.
I just saw their brains leave their body
and
land in my wife's lap. But
yeah, but you know, it, where does it go?
I certainly felt the
spirit. We've taken those home
in Egypt. I mean, it wasn't combat, but in the Great Pyramid, way down in there, it was like, it was heavy beyond description. And Kirkuk, Iraq, you know, that's where Daniel ended
up. Oh, yeah.
So,
Samara. I felt it in Samara.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean.
And Israel, like, I was also blessed. I prayed. You were talking about this. We'll wrap it up. But when God, you know, said to you, and I think it's PT, I'll use his initials.
Yeah.
To go do what you're doing. I prayed in 09, like, I wanted to do language, the Arabic course. I prayed in Kirkuk, Iraq, and it was like, pachow, like, should I do this? And God was like, absolutely. So I ended up being the first and only class to go to Israel for, you know, most of a year and study the language. And it was in Jerusalem and just Nazareth, you know, everywhere for, you know, only most of a year, but you got some real time there, and your book shows it, because how you connect the David and Goliath story. Like, you went like, wait a minute, you know, you can still do that stuff. Time shrinks when you see that, you know, from Abraham, it's really been about 130, 120, 140 generations.
Yeah.
That's 4,000 years, 3,800 years, but it shrinks when it comes into perspective. So your book did that so well, man. And I think it's coming, boss.
Yeah, I think so too.
It's a coming.
Well, thank you guys. Again, I appreciate the encouragement. It's great seeing you both. Thank you guys. Thanks for putting me on the show. Hopefully we reach somebody, Lord, all seven of them.
We're going to grow. We're like proud of that in the right way.
Yeah. If it's seven, it's seven. That's something.
There's two people in India that watched a show talking about Laura's new TBI that she has. She's in the club now. She walked into the corner of a car door. She skewered her eye socket with a car door. And then got headbutted by a kid. Like, she's got TBI. Classic symptoms. Oh.
Welcome to the club, Laura. It's its own journey. Enjoy it.
You want to enjoy it? Will you pray us out, sweetie?
Yes. Oh, dear Father God, thank you so much for this time with Jeff and talking about you and talking about our faith. We pray, Father, that you will bless Jeff and his family and his book and his mission that he has now. We are so grateful to have friends like this and be able to talk about you like this. And we just pray that it continues, it grows, and that Jeff will be successful with his book, because we know that he will be continuing to do your work, Father. Okay. So we ask all this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Jeff, thank you so much. God bless you, brother. We're going to keep praying for you. Love you, man. Got your back always. And we'll talk when we talk, brother.
Yeah, great to reconnect. I'll talk with you more as I'm digging through this next one, brother.
All right, man.
Hear what you have to say about it. Bless you guys.
Thanks, Jeff. God bless you, brother. Thanks.